of the morning, 2311741 LE versus Superintendent of Cobb County School District. You're saving 30 minutes for rebuttal?
3 minutes.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Claire Sherburn. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, who are students with severe immune deficiency and respiratory disorders living in the Cobb County School District. And we're here today for two reasons. First, because in an order denying preliminary injunctive relief, the district court dismissed two of the plaintiffs from this case outright. That decision must be reversed because it ignores the plaintiff's well-pled claims for damages and because it erred in its holding that students lack standing to seek injunctive relief in this case. In that same order, the district court denied the remaining students' preliminary injunction after bypassing the required analysis on their failure to accommodate claims under the ADA and Section 504. And we're asking that decision be reversed and remanded with instructions to conduct a proper analysis and get to the remaining issues on the preliminary injunction.
Let me ask you kind of a threshold question. Do the two students who left the school district and went to private school intend to return to the school district if they receive injunctive relief? Is there evidence of that in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, there is evidence of that in the record. They've both submitted affidavits at the outset of the case that they intended to return and that they would return if the CCSD accommodated them as requested. They've submitted supplemental affidavits since then, since they've been in private school. One of the students, AZ, her parent has expressed that she'd prefer for AZ to be at CCSD, but she can't currently without accommodations. The other student has also indicated that the reason that they're not enrolled in the CCSD is because of the CCSD's failure to accommodate them.
I'm somewhat confused. Can you tell me specifically, if we were to rule in your favor, what exactly is the relief that you're seeking?
From the district court on preliminary injunction, we're seeking an order that the CCSD allow students' school-based teams to consider students' requested accommodations. In this case, the hang-up is close contact, mandatory masking during periods of elevated illness.
So when you say mandatory masking, what you're saying is that you want all the students to wear masks?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, no.
But that's why I'm asking, because it's unclear to me, what is the relief that you're seeking?
Yes, and we're seeking individualized relief. We have four plaintiffs here, and we understand that each of them might need something slightly different to be safe in their classrooms. The problem is that CCSD has a policy that precludes their school-based teams from even considering implementing masking on any level for any of these students.
But the students are not prohibited from wearing masks, correct?
That's correct.
Right. So again, I'm going to ask again, what exactly are you seeking? What is the relief that you're seeking? Because the individualized students, the four students, can wear masks. They can go to school and wear a mask all day. So what exactly are you seeking?
That's correct. We're seeking a modification of CCSD's policy that precludes students' teams from considering implementing masking.
Again, you're speaking gibberish. What exactly does that mean?
We believe that these students are entitled to close contact masking, meaning the masking of those directly around them during...
Okay, so in essence, what you want is for the other individual students to wear masks in the classroom when the four students are in the classroom, correct?
Correct, if the team decides that's necessary.
How do you get past a Georgia law that does not allow for masking unless there's an opt-out provision?
We don't believe that what we're asking is inconsistent with an opt-out provision. Certainly, we don't want to be overly prescriptive in the way that CCSD implements this, which is why we're asking that their school-based teams have the discretion to consider the accommodations that students are requesting. And so if students wanted to opt out, certainly I don't see our relief as being at odds with that. Just as an example, if this helps to illustrate exactly what this might look like for students, BB is a student with muscular dystrophy. He has severe respiratory dysfunction and a very low immune system.
That BB?
BB, yes.
Right.
And he has a one-to-one aide that helps him throughout the day with basic functions. They're in very close proximity to each other. So during periods of elevated illness, BB might require that that person wear a mask. Now, the reason I don't think that's necessarily inconsistent with...
But again, BB himself or herself, I don't know who the student is, can wear a mask all day during the school day.
That's correct.
Correct. Yes. So again, what you're trying to do is backdoor a mask mandate for the other individuals in the school.
We're seeking reasonable accommodations.
Okay, but the reasonable accommodation here is BB transitions during classes before other students to avoid congested hallways. The staff makes sure that there's proper hygiene in the classrooms. They're notified, the parents are notified if there's any kind of disease that's spreading in the school. I mean, there's accommodations and reasonable accommodations that are being made for the two individual students that are remaining in the school. So again, that's why I ask, what is the relief that you're seeking? Because it seems to me that you're just trying to backdoor a mask mandate.
We are seeking that CCSD require masks to the extent that they're necessary for these individual students. That's correct.
Subject to an opt-out under the Georgia law.
Yes, and on an individualized basis. And we do believe there's some issues with the district court's analysis here regarding the CCSD's accommodations that the CCSD has provided, and we don't believe the district court was correct to rule that those accommodations allow these students an equal opportunity to access their in-person education, which is what's required under the ADA.
So let me ask you, it seems to me there are sort of two things going on here. On the one hand, you think, or you contend that an across-the-board rule, right, no mask mandates, is it your contention that that, like, ipso facto violates the ADA?
No, Your Honor.
So tell me, like, what's the legal problem with that? I know that you say we need individualized determinations, but is the lack of an individualized determination itself violative of the ADA?
Not necessarily, unless it works the denial of otherwise reasonable and necessary accommodations, which we maintain that that's what's happened in this case.
I mean, the reason I ask is that, as I understand sort of this four-part test, right, once you've made it through the threshold of step one, now step two seems to me reasonable accommodations without fundamental alteration, right? Three seems to be necessity. And so the individualization seems to me, by reference to the Casey Martin case and otherwise, to go really to step two. So it might even be, that the lack of an individualized determination might render this violative of step two. But now you've still got to pass through step three. So now we're really just looking at this, the collection of other accommodations and whether that's necessary. And I think the individualization at that point kind of like drops out of the case, because now we're still looking at this bucket of accommodations, and is this thing enough to give your clients a comparable experience to the other students?
I agree, Your Honor, and I don't think the core problem here is for the perspective of this appeal, I don't think the core problem is CCSD's refusal to conduct an individualized inquiry. The core problem is that the district court students were denied reasonable and necessary modifications. We brought this before the district court, and we asked the district court to do the individualized inquiry that would be required. And then the district court also bypassed that analysis, in our view, because the entire failure to accommodate analysis should be focused on the students' requested accommodations. The reasonableness analysis, the district court should first look to the students' requested accommodations, and then if those requested accommodations are facially reasonable, the only way for the district to sort of overcome that reasonableness element is to show that those accommodations would work an undue burden on the defendant's programs. But
or right at step three, that they're not necessary to provide a comparable experience. And I guess I took the district court's analysis really ultimately to like bottom on that. The district court said, okay, but there are these other accommodations, and they seem to have been effective. And if that's a fact finding with respect to necessity, that might be a tough thing for you to get reversed.
Well, the problem with that is that there's an 11th Circuit case, it's a Fair Housing Act case, we believe it's instructive here, called Begaida v. Altamonte Heights Condominiums, that says explicitly that alternative accommodations aren't relevant to the necessity analysis. The necessity analysis, just like the reasonableness analysis, looks specifically at what the plaintiff has requested and whether what the plaintiff has requested would address the barriers that the plaintiff is facing to accessing the program. And if it would, and if it would allow the plaintiff to access the program, then the student is entitled to their requested accommodation, in our view. And so what the district court did was it found that students' requested accommodations were facially reasonable. It didn't require any showing from the district that those accommodations would be unduly burdensome. And then it just sort of set that aside and went on to consider whether CCSD's accommodations were reasonable. But what it should have done was then consider, are students' requested accommodations necessary to allow them to access CCSD's existing program? Not the alternative accommodations that they've offered, but the existing program. And that's the exact factual scenario that the court outlines in Begaida, where the plaintiff requests a service animal that exceeds the housing authority's pet weight limit. The housing authority says, you can't do that, but you can have this other pet, which would also alleviate the effects of your disability that's under the pet weight limit. And the court says, no, you can't consider that. You have to look at the plaintiff's requested accommodation first. And so we maintain that the district court made the same error here, and it should be reversed and remanded with instructions to proceed under the correct analysis.
But again, I go back to, you keep saying that you did not get the requested accommodations, but the requested accommodations were, in essence, that you want students and teachers to wear masks when the two students who are there and the two who are no longer there, if they're in the classroom, that they wear masks. The district court judge determined under, I think, a necessity argument, or the necessity prong, that was not necessary given the other things that the school is doing, and given also the fact that even the CCD doesn't require masking anymore. So I'm not sure how you can get past that prong.
Again, it's our contention that Begaida would require the district court to first look just at, do the students need an accommodation to access the generally applicable existing program? And if the answer to that question is yes, which I believe that it was here, the district court has never held that students...
Well, two of the students are in school. Two are now attending a private school.
Correct.
So I'm not sure that it was required for him to make that even finding or determination.
Yes,
because obviously accommodations are being made because two of the students are in school.
Yes, it's our contention that for those two students, where I agree with you that he only assessed the question with regard to those two students, and for them he should have looked at what were they requesting and looked at were those requests, if students were accommodated in the way that they requested, would that allow them access to the CCSD's program? And it was error for the district court to rely on the CCSD's alternatives, and we believe that error is subject to reversal under Begaida and under Shaw and Unger v. Majorca as well, which I think highlight that throughout the analysis, the focus here should be on the plaintiff's requested accommodation.
But if I understand Judge Lagoa's question correctly, I think she's saying that you're saying you can't consider the alternate accommodations at step three, but I think she's saying you could consider them when determining the necessity of the accommodations that the students requested. Is that right? And if not, why not?
I believe that Begaida stands for the premise that under the necessity prong, which I think is step three, but please correct me if we're understanding that.
I may have said the wrong number.
that what I think of as step three is the necessity prong. I think Begaida is clear with regard to the necessity prong, that alternative accommodations aren't relevant. The question is just, does the plaintiff need an accommodation? And then the question becomes, would the plaintiff's requested accommodation allow them the access that they're seeking? That's how I view necessity under Begaida. Now, I think a defendant's alternative accommodations could be relevant to a reasonableness inquiry. But in that case, the defendant would have to show that students' requested accommodations would be unduly burdensome in light of the defendant's alternatives. And I just don't think that the district court's order supports any such a finding.
There's case law, and it's we certainly have case law that says just the fact that you want a certain accommodation does not mean that that's the accommodation that you get. So if you have a student in a wheelchair and the school decides to do a ramp versus a lift, and the student prefers a lift, there's no violation as long as the school provides a reasonable accommodation. You don't get to pick the accommodation.
I actually think the district court gets that wrong, Your Honor. Most of the cases that say plaintiffs aren't entitled to their preferred accommodations are saying plaintiffs aren't entitled to unreasonable accommodations. And the court in Unger v. Majorca, I think, lays
you're entitled to a reasonable accommodation.
Correct. And if the plaintiff's requested accommodation is reasonable, the plaintiff is unnecessary, then the plaintiff is entitled to that accommodation.
That is not what the law is. That's completely not true.
I direct the court to Unger v. Majorca, which says, while we've acknowledged that a plaintiff is not entitled to his requested accommodation, we concluded that so long as the plaintiff's request is facially reasonable, the burden shifts to the defendant, who must show that the accommodation would nonetheless impose an undue burden or result in a fundamental alteration. I think that lays out our position relatively clearly on that point, and I see I'm well over time, and I apologize for that, so I'll save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please this court, Brandon Rular for the appellees. For the second time, the district court has refused the extraordinary request by the plaintiffs to grant a preliminary injunction, and we ask this court to affirm the most recent denial. This court can get there one of two ways. It can find, one, that the plaintiffs don't have standing to seek injunctive relief, and two, it can find that the plaintiffs cannot satisfy all the Rule 65 factors, in particular, that they are not substantially likely to prevail in the merits of their failure to accommodate claims. I'll start with the standing issue.
And just so I'm clear, you don't dispute standing with respect to any damages claims?
Well, Your Honor, we do think they have problems with respect to their damages claims, just given the fact that it's predicated on the notion that this threat of harm that they would have endured if they had gone to school without a mask mandate in place. For purposes of this appeal, this court does not have to decide that today. I'm talking specifically about their standing for injunctive relief.
So in either respect, the case doesn't just go away. Like, we can't sort of nuke this case and avoid the merits by deciding standing. You're just trying to carve out. We're going to have to decide the merits one way or the other. You agree with that?
Well, Your Honor, my druthers, this court would dismiss the whole thing and say, no, it's inherently speculative even at its outset. But for purposes of this appeal, yes, I do think we're just trying to carve out the future relief and we can deal with what's left on remand.
Let me just ask you this. I tend to think, to the extent there's a justiciability issue in the case, I'm not sure there is, but to the extent there is one, I tend to think of it in mootness terms, not standing terms. Why do you think it's standing? And does it matter?
To answer your second question, I don't think it matters. I do think it is a standing problem with respect to the overarching problem, Article 3 problem that all the plaintiffs have, which is that their claim for future relief has to be predicated on Title II's core promise of meaningful access. So in other words, they have to allege that they were denied access by virtue of the fact that the district does not allow mandatory masking as a reasonable accommodation. And they try to divorce that from the threat of catching COVID, but those two things are inextricably linked. So what they're really saying is that we're being harmed. We are entitled to future relief because we will suffer a denial of meaningful access in the future because the risk of catching COVID is too great. And when you're talking about, and that's true at the beginning of their case, and it's true now, and it's even more true now. So when you're talking about this kind of future risk type claim, Clapper tells us that the standard we're looking at is whether the threatened harm is certainly impending, not possible, not likely, certainly impending. And the plaintiff simply can't show that. There's nothing in the record that shows that going forward, they would have faced a certainly impending risk of catching COVID.
I guess I thought that the way they would characterize their injury is not necessarily the future threat of catching COVID, but the present denial of individualized treatment. to which they say they're entitled under the statute.
Your Honor, I'm not sure there's a little distinction between those two things.
Well, I mean, they might say that the individualized treatment they think will prevent some horrible eventuality, but I think that, I mean, I think I could be wrong about this, but I thought that they would characterize their harm as like a present harm. We are being denied individualized treatment like right now.
So, the individualized treatment, it can't be unmoored from the remedial purpose of Title II, which is to grant meaningful access to the programs and activities of public institution, and in this case, based on this court's prior decision, last time this case was up in front of y'all, found that we talk about programs and activities in this context, we're talking about in-person education. So the claim that they're being denied individualized accommodations can't be divorced from the core remedial purpose of Title II, which is to ensure meaningful access, and on the flip side, to prohibit a denial of access based on disability.
But to the extent you're arguing about changed circumstances, that's a mootness argument, not a standing argument, isn't it?
That is correct as a general principle, Your Honor. And I would say that the plaintiffs had this standing problem, this clapper standing problem for future relief, even at the time that they filed suit. If this court wants to analyze that as a mootness problem now, based on the changed circumstances with respect to our relationship and how we're living with COVID-19, it can do that, and the outcome is still the same. But I think that it can be analyzed as a clapper standing problem, even from the outset. Now, the case is different for AZ and CS, and I'll get to that in a second. And I'll note that, you know, over the last 2 years, every circuit court that has considered the theory that the plaintiffs are putting forward in this case has rejected it for either a standing or a mootness problem. So I'm talking about ET v. Paxton and the Fifth Circuit, which is a standing decision. ARC of Iowa v. Reynolds and the Eighth Circuit, another standing decision. RK v. Lee and the Sixth Circuit, which is a mootness decision. And I'll even throw in there the Healy case from the First Circuit. I apologize, Your Honor, that I don't have the site right in front of me, but it's in our supplemental authorities notice. And that's a First Circuit decision that found slightly factually different, since the court found that there was no standing to seek injunctive relief prohibiting school closures in the event that there was a spike in COVID cases. So the court found that that's inherently speculative, it's hypothetical, it's not sufficient to show certainly impending harm. So it's not on all fours factually, but we do think it supports our case. So
isn't Paxton, I guess I took on the standing issue, I took Paxton probably to be your best case, closest. But isn't even Paxton a little bit different? Because there, didn't the Fifth Circuit say some version of it, I'm paraphrasing, but that the plaintiffs there really hadn't requested this individualized consideration. And so, like, you know, I think, as I recall, the Fifth Circuit said, like, well, that's not enough because they didn't seek that here. And I guess I took the claim here to be like, oh, we are definitely seeking that. That's sort of the core of our argument, is that we think we're entitled to individualized consideration.
I think that is something in the Paxton decision. I wouldn't say the case hinges on that by any means. I mean, the central thrust of the court's main argument in that opinion, the Fifth Circuit's main argument in that opinion, is that when a plaintiff, a disabled student in particular, challenges a mask mandate ban based on the premise that without it, it violates their right to an individualized inquiry under the ADA or the right to impose masking on others as a reasonable accommodation, that threat and harm is far too speculative to support Article III standing. That's the main thrust of Paxton as we read it. And the subsequent decision, or a later decision from the Eighth Circuit in ARC of Iowa, really puts a fine point on that and adopts the Fifth Circuit's reasoning and says...
May I ask a question? My understanding of the record is that the two students, I'm not talking about the two students who are not here, but BB and HHB, I guess, and LE, they actually do have a plan that they met with the school, and they have an individualized plan as to how to proceed in the school.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
And that the issue is that this individualized treatment that they received is not just offered to students who are disabled. There's that treatment program, or the whatever the program is called, is given to a variety of students, including those who are not disabled?
If I'm understanding your question, okay, let me answer that to the best I understood it. Before the 22-23 school year, LE, the two students that are still enrolled in the Cobb County School District, LE and BB, their IEP teams, so their Section 504 teams, met and to come up with an individualized set of accommodations for them so they could return to school during the 22-23 school year. And they did in some capacity. And their attendance that year looks like it did prior to COVID. So if we're talking about the sufficiency of the district's measures and accommodations that it's giving to these particular students to protect them from COVID, that's what they pled. And the district has done that. And their attendance now and their academic performance and their record.
Right, because BB had, even before COVID, had never had fewer than 21 absences from the school year.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
So one of the accommodations the students requested, or one of the students requested, I'm not sure, was a separate space for taking standardized tests. Is that an accommodation that's been provided by the school district?
I don't remember off the top of my head who asked for that, but that is not currently an accommodation in place for LE or BB, but I don't think there's evidence of the record that that was denied for either of those two students.
But so there are at least some requested accommodations that have not been granted by the school district, isn't that right?
Again, I'm not sure that LE...
Even if we put masks aside in another category.
I'm not sure that that's the case for the two students that are enrolled in the school district, LE or BB, whether they've actually been denied a particular accommodation.
I'm not talking about been denied. I'm talking about has it been provided.
Has it been provided to LE or
BB? That particular accommodation been provided to the students?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. In terms of what's in the record and what we've put forward, that is not... a separate location for testing is not a part of that list.
Okay, and with respect to masks, your brief seems to say that Georgia law doesn't allow schools to require teachers and staff to wear masks in addition to students, and the district court seemed to have the same assumption, but I didn't see that in Georgia law. Does Georgia law prohibit requiring non-students, such as teachers and staff, from having to wear masks?
My understanding of the statutes we cited, and I don't have those right in front of me, is that taken together, they do prohibit a mask mandate, an opt-out-less mask mandate on students and staff and employees alike.
So there's no other statute other than those that have been identified in the briefing?
No, Your Honor.
Right, so if I didn't see those words in those statutes, then it doesn't exist in Georgia law. Is that right?
I do think it is in the statute. Again, I don't have it in front of me, but I accept your premise, Your Honor.
All right, so it seems that perhaps we've kind of turned to the merits. We've bled ourselves into the merits, which for my purposes is just fine. Can you respond to your colleague's contention about this case Begaida or Begaida, and whether or not it precludes the consideration of alternative accommodations in the necessity prong?
Yeah, I don't think that's what it stands for. I mean, this court has looked to other accommodations in place when assessing whether let me back up. So we'll start from the premise that plaintiffs are not entitled to their preferred accommodation. And again, not to sound like a broken record, but we when we're talking about accommodations and compliance with Title II, we have to look at the statute's core guarantee of meaningful access. And Shaw v. Habitat for Humanity reminds us of that. It's a case that comes after Begaida. So we can't just look at necessity in the abstract. We have to look at it as far as what the statute's remedial purpose is, the remedial purpose here being ensuring equal access to in-person education. So when you're looking at that, when you're looking at a particular accommodation and you're assessing the necessity prong, there can't be a violation of the ADA simply because you say no to an accommodation request when the other accommodations that are in place ensure meaningful access. You've complied with Title II, and there's nothing in Title II, and I'm not sure that I haven't seen anything in this court's case law that suggests that Title II is violated simply because you deny a request for accommodation the plaintiff doesn't need to access face-to-face instruction or in-person instruction. So I think that's a misreading of Begaida. I understand that there's some kind of confusing language in that decision, but I think Shaw sort of sets the record straight on that we have to look at the notion of necessity in conjunction with the remedial purpose.
And that's your understanding, is that what they're seeking is in-person access?
Yes, I mean, this court decided, again, the first time this case came up, that the program and activity that's at issue here, that we need to make, that the district needs to make sure that they're allowing equal access to, is in-person instruction.
Could you address, I know your time is over, but could you address the two students who are no longer in attending the Cobb school district?
Certainly, Your Honor. So we think that they have an independent Article III problem. Whether you call that standing or mootness, I could see that mootness is probably the better framework for that. They haven't been in the Cobb County School District for more than 2 years at this point. They're not subject to the district's policies. The district's stance on mandatory masking as reasonable accommodation does not affect them as far as what accommodations are available to them at their new schools.
But what about the affidavits that say, hey, we'd really like to come back to Cobb County?
I would say that that's still in the words of Lujan, a someday intention, that there's no definite plans to return. And even on top of that, if the plaintiff, Judge Legault, I think you asked my friend on the other side this question, if they get the injunction here, all it says is that the IEP teams and the Section 504 teams must consider a mandatory masking as a reasonable accommodation. So you're talking about speculation on speculation that their 504 teams, that one, they would return when that injunction gets issued. Two, that their 504 teams would agree that masking is a reasonable and necessary accommodation. And two, that it would even be effective to accommodate their individual disabilities, given the fact that the district can't make anybody wear masks, can't make employees, and it can't make students wear masks. So we think that they have an independent standing problem. And that is an independent grounds for.
Is there, I don't think this is in the record, but the Cobb school district, are the teachers there, is there like a contract, an employment contract with the teachers?
Yes, most teachers have a contract for a term, it's for a year, yes. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few things quickly. First, I just want to clarify, because I think there's been some conflation of the preliminary injunctive relief that plaintiffs are seeking and their overall request for relief in this case. For the overall case, plaintiffs have requested that the CCSD modify its policies to comply with CDC guidance and maintain compliance with that guidance going forward, and to accommodate the students as they need with reasonable accommodations. And so for preliminary injunctive relief, we attempted to tailor that request as much as possible just to make sure that students' teams could consider their request. But going forward, we are requesting that students be accommodated. And so I understand that COVID presents a unique set of circumstances here, but this is a classic failure.
But the CCD guidance no longer requires any masking.
That's correct, yes, and we dispute that.
But you just said that if we granted the preliminary injunction, the permanent injunction you would be seeking would be to follow CCD guidance, but CCD guidance no longer requires masking, correct?
That's correct, but it does suggest that school districts consider masking for students who are at high risk of illness, like the students.
But again, your clients can wear a mask. They're not prohibited from wearing a mask.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. I just want to clarify that we are requesting that our students be accommodated in this case, not just...
But again, the accommodation that you want is for other people to wear masks, correct?
That's correct, yes.
All right.
With regard to mootness versus standing, I just want to clarify, it does matter, and the reason that it matters is because for this case to be moot, the CCSD would have to show that no relief whatsoever remains available to these children, and that's just not the case here. There's record evidence that these children want to come back to school, and the reason they're not back in school is because of the district's failure to accommodate them. That would clearly be redressed if the district did accommodate them, and so this case is not moved, and students have standing for that same reason. I also just want to remind the court that we're at the pleading stage here, and so The barrier to students' ability to access their education is COVID-19, but students don't have to prove that they're going to contract COVID-19 to have standing to proceed on a failure to accommodate claim. People request accommodations all the time to protect their health and safety, and we don't make them prove that the harm that they're seeking to protect against would certainly befall them absent the accommodation. It's enough to allege and support with facts that barriers exist and that students or plaintiffs have been denied accommodations that would allow them to overcome those barriers, and that's the case here. As far as the other circuit decisions, we're not operating under the same theory as opposing counsel has said. We're operating under a different theory. Again, this is a failure to accommodate claim. In those other cases, the plaintiffs brought generalized challenges to statewide statutes.
But again, the failure to accommodate, I just want to understand, if we were writing an opinion, the failure to accommodate is what?
That students have been denied necessary and reasonable accommodations.
What are the reasonable accommodations that have been denied? Can you articulate them? If we were writing an opinion and we did A, B, C, D, what are the reasonable accommodations that have been denied?
Sure. For example, Judge Pryor asked about a separate space for testing. A student did request a separate space.
Who requested that?
CS. It's on page 130 of the record in volume one.
Wait, CS is the student that's no longer there, correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
And he was denied. AZ has requested that she be allowed to have space for breathing speech.
And AZ also is no longer there, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, but let's talk about the two students who are actually in school. Okay, what reasonable accommodations have been denied to them?
Yes, they requested that people in close proximity to them wear masks.
Okay, so again, you want other individuals to wear masks. That's what they want. Okay, what else?
They've requested social distancing beyond what the school has implemented.
Okay, and what else?
They've requested that CCSD implement ventilation procedures. And there's factual dispute about this. And so
it's fine. I just need to know. Give me the reasonable accommodations that your client, the two that are in school, has requested that have not been granted.
Yes, I think masking on some level, a higher level of social distancing, improved air ventilation. I mean, they've made requests for sanitation, other things as well.
But there are the classrooms are being sanitized, my understanding is.
That's correct, yes.
Okay.
And I see that my time is up, so I just respectfully ask that this court reverse the district court's decision to dismiss AZ and CS outright in order that they be reinstated to this case, and reverse and remand the preliminary injunctions with instructions for the district court to proceed under a correct analysis. Thank you.
Thank you to counsel on both sides. Court will be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Okay.